Hey everybody, I'm Julie and I'm an alcoholic. Let's have an AA meeting. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. Hey everybody, I'm Julie and I'm an alcoholic. Let's have an AA meeting. Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
My name's Amy and I'm an alcoholic. This is a reading based on the passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describe in their own language and from their own point of view and the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our memberships and clear-cut ideas of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker and we believe that it is only fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Now I get to introduce the speaker. Well, I have known Garland for a long time. And he gives me inspiration. When I think he was telling his story, I asked to introduce him. And he knew it was me when I patted him on the head. Because that's all I used to do. Never said nothing, just pat him on the head, and he knew it was me. So I give y'all Garland.
My name is Garland, and I am an alcoholic. And as you can tell from the dark glasses and the white cane, when your mama told you to stop doing that, she knew what she was talking about. My blindness is the result of a horrible accident. My parents had sex. I am an only child, which is always a surprise to my sister and my two brothers. I was raised in a good Christian home by good Christian parents with good Christian morals. I'm sure that that's what drove me to drink. I couldn't measure up to their example. My sister would come home with a report card, and if it had a B on it, my parents would ask her, "You couldn't do any better," and she would cry and run to her room and study, and she would come home with all A's on the next report card. And the same with my two brothers. They would say, "You couldn't do any better," and they would come home with A's on the next report card, and I would come home with a B on a report card, and my parents would say, "You couldn't do any better," so I'd come home with straight F's on the next one. If a B wasn't good enough for you, let's see if this works. I remember when I had my first sponsor, he asked me to pray every morning to God to please help me stay sober for the day. And at night, when I got down on my knees to thank God for another day of sobriety, and I said, "Well, what if I don't believe in God?" And he said, "I didn't ask you if you believe in God. Do you believe that I believe in God?" And I had to say, yeah, because it was obvious that my sponsor did believe in God. And he said, okay. At night, you get down on your knees and you say, God that my sponsor believes in, thank you for another day of sobriety. And in the morning, you say, God that my sponsor believes in, please give me another day of sobriety. It kind of takes all the argument out of it, doesn't it? See, I was in a halfway house, and whenever somebody came in that said, oh, I don't believe in God, we'd spend about a month running around trying to prove to them that there was a God, and I believed in God. Again, I was raised in a good Christian home. We went to church, and I believed in God. I have always been about doing the barest minimum possible. And that's all I was doing when I told him, well, I don't know. I told you all about the blindness. It is a hereditary disease. My retina is slowly dying out, and in fact, I'm totally blind now. But when I was born profoundly hard of hearing, and to this day I still wear hearing aids. And at the time in the 60s when I had my first hearing aid, it was in a box that you wore in your shirt pocket and had wires that went up to your head. So not only did I feel like I was from a different planet, but I looked like I was in constant contact with the mothership. And at the time, my eyeglasses were so thick that I needed a neck brace to hold my head up. And I could set fire to other planets through the lenses. And I felt different. And I was treated different. I'm not going to go into a long drunk log because there's really only two drinks y'all need to hear about, the first one and the last one. The first drink was on Halloween night, 1974. My older brother and a bunch of our friends, we pulled our money together and got a couple of bottles of Boone Farm Strawberry Hill. It was about 69 cents a bottle back then. I can't imagine it much more than that now. And I drank a half a bottle of Boone Farm Strawberry Hill, and the eyeglasses melted away, and the hearing aids faded, and I could dance. I could tell jokes. If there had been girls there, I'd have been a great lover. And I thought to myself, wow, my parents have been wasting a lot of money on psychiatrists. With 69 cents, I've got the cure. About an hour later, I sat up, I threw up, and passed out, and couldn't wait to do it again. And almost from the very start, I was a daily drinker. My drinking progressed to, at the time of my last drink, I was drinking 2/5 of gin a day. And I was going down to the grocery store. See, in New Orleans, gas stations can sell alcohol. I don't know how you people do it. How do y'all plan around when the liquor store is open? And my God, you can't even buy it on Sundays. And how do y'all become alcoholics? That takes too much work. But anyway, I would go down to the grocery store. It opened up at 6:30 in the morning, and I would go and get my first fifth of gin at 6:30 in the morning. And then when the shift changed at 2 o'clock, I would go back and get my second fifth of gin. I didn't want to get both fifths at the same time because I didn't want them to think I was an alcoholic. You know, like there was a long line of us social drinkers there at 6:30 in the morning. And but I remember coming home after buying my first fifth of gin for the day, and I was carrying it very carefully and making sure to cross with the light, and I'm coming home on the sidewalk, and I said, God, I can't go on like this. Please help me. Now, I did not mean, God, please make me sober. What I meant was, God, send me a rich woman that'll go to the store and get my fifth of gin for me. And 2 weeks later, I went to a wine and cheese art showing with a date, and I had two glasses of white wine, and I didn't know about the phenomenon of craving that starts when we take so much as one drink of alcohol, but I told her, wow, I only had two glasses of white wine. And she said, that's wonderful. She still didn't come into the condo with me. And she dropped me off, and that's the last thing I remember. Now, I've heard people say, oh, if you can't remember your last drunk, you haven't had it. And show me that in the big book. Because on page 24, it says, we cannot bring into recollection the horrors of a week or a month ago. I don't remember what happened after she dropped me off. It was on a Sunday night when she dropped me off, and on Tuesday morning I came to, and I was at my parents' house. The condo was about 4 miles away from my parents' house, and it was across I-10. I-10 and I-85 have a lot in common. They're always busy, so how I managed to cross I-10 to get to my parents' house, I still don't know. But I came to in my parents' house, and I staggered down the hall, and my dad was waiting in the kitchen for me. And he said, sit down, we need to talk. Which is always a good sign, isn't it? And he said, son, your mother and I, we can't afford your drinking anymore. Which I knew was bull. They had jobs. They could afford my drinking just fine. I was the one hawking all of my stuff to pay for my drinking. They could afford it. But my dad said, you've got three choices. You can either go to a treatment center and get sober, or you can go to a mental institution because, son, we think you're crazy. Or you can move in with your mother and I, and we will keep you sober. And I knew if I moved in with my parents, I would need the mental institution, so I went to treatment. And in the back of my head, I always had the idea that I would stay sober for 6 months. That would prove to my parents I wasn't an alcoholic. I could go back to drinking. They could go back to paying my bills. Everybody would be happy. That condominium that date dropped me off at, my parents had bought that condominium for me. And when my dad handed me the key, he said, this is so that we'll know where to find your body. Because they were tired of me pulling midnight moves. I actually got it down to a science where I could move an entire apartment in 30 minutes and be long gone before the landlord came for that last month's rent. Anyway, I went to the treatment center, and my first 4 days of sobriety were wonderful. They shot me so full of phenobarbital, I was floating. My fifth day, I'm chasing them around with my pants around my ankles, waiting for my shot, and they wouldn't give it to me. I never want to sober up again. That is the definition of hell. I literally felt like I was burning alive, coming down from the phenobarbital and the alcohol. And see, I've been drinking for so long and drinking so much that my heart literally could not keep up with detoxing. They had to shoot me with phenobarbital to keep me alive. And for the 29 days that I was there for the 28-day program, I did really well there. They never could get a steady pulse out of me. And I did so well at the treatment center that they recommended that I carry the message to a halfway house. This is how sick I was. I honestly thought they were sending me to the halfway house for a job interview. Because I had done so well in treatment that you know, surely they want me to carry the message to them. And reality intervened, or I came to, en route to the halfway house, and I turned to my dad and I said, do I have to stay here? And he said, no, you're an adult. We'll find you a nice cardboard box for you to live in. Anyway, we pulled up to the halfway house, and there were four little girls sitting out front smoking cigarettes, and I said, I'll stay. It takes what it takes, huh? And I went into the halfway house. And are there any halfway house people here tonight? Absolutely. Yeah. I'm grateful to my halfway house. They did two things that are invaluable to me. Number one, they got me into the habit of going to meetings. At 11:30, if you weren't at school and you weren't at work, you put your books away and you went to a noon meeting. And at 7:30, if you weren't at school or weren't at work, you put your books away and you went to the 8 o'clock meeting. They got me into the habit of going to meetings, even though I didn't know why we were going to meetings, other than they had real coffee at the meetings. And you could tell who was from my halfway house. We were the ones circling the coffee pot, waiting for it to stop dripping. But it got me into the habit of going to meetings. And later on, they said, okay, you need to get a sponsor. So they got me to get a sponsor. I went to the noon meeting and got a bunch of phone numbers, and I came home to the halfway house with those phone numbers, and I said, okay, I got all these women's phone numbers, and and they made me throw those numbers away, and they said, no, you need to get somebody who's got what you want. It just made me throw their numbers away. But there was this guy that was at the meeting, and he had money in his pocket, and he had a pretty girlfriend, and he had a nice place to live, and I wanted money in my pocket and a pretty girlfriend and a nice place to live. And he had one thing that I knew I would never have. So it's kind of like, why even bother asking for it, because I'll never get it. But people respected him. When he shared in meetings, people listened. People respected what he had to say, because he backed it up with experience, strength, and hope. It wasn't his opinion. And you could tell he was speaking the language of the heart. And I knew I would never get that. I didn't respect myself. How in the hell would anybody else respect me? But I asked him to be my sponsor because he was such a nice guy. I mean, every time I went to meetings, he would ask me, hey, Garland, how are you? How's it? And he seemed like he really cared how I was doing and what was going on. And so I asked him to be my sponsor, and he quit being a nice guy. My first meeting after asking him to be my sponsor, he had me doing service work. First thing he had me doing was putting out ashtrays. And if it was a big book study, he had me putting out the ashtrays and the big books. And if it was 12 and 12 study, ashtrays, 12 and 12. I mean, I got really creative. Three chairs, ashtray, two chairs, big book, three chairs. I mean, I got artistic with it. And anyway, he had me doing service work. I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not just a visitor. But my very first meeting with him as my sponsor, he put me by the front door and he said, okay, greet people as they come in. I said, why? He said, so that they'll know they're in the right place. Oh, okay. And 10 minutes later, he walked back over and said, greet the men too, okay? And then he had me get down on my knees and say, God, please keep me sober today. God, thank you for another day of sobriety. I worked my first step with that man. I'd graduated from the halfway house, and he had a condominium in Lafayette, Louisiana. And he had a month left on the lease, and he said, here, you can stay there. And he took an hour off of work and came and got me, and we went to the A&P grocery store. And we walked up one aisle and down another aisle and up another aisle. And he turned to me and he said, Garland, are you going to get anything? And for 8 months, I had eaten whatever was put in front of me. I'd eaten whatever was put in front of me. In fact, my first night at the halfway house, I had my arm around my plate, guarding it. And this young man looked across the table and said, Garland, nobody's going to take your food. you don't have to protect it. But I had eaten whatever was put in front of me, and for 8 months I didn't have to make any choices, any decisions, anything. And I said the first honest words I'd said in a long time to anyone when I turned to him and I said, I don't know what I like to eat. Please help me. And I could have starved to death in an A&P grocery store. How cool would that look on a tombstone? I quit playing games that day. I quit trying to be cool. I quit playing games. This is life or death. So I worked my first step in a grocery store with my sponsor when I realized that I am powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. And part of the reason why that day is so significant to me is it was my 28th birthday. I was a grown man that could not make simple decisions. Do I like vegetable soup or chicken noodle soup? Do I like apple juice or orange juice? Or do I like both? The second step to me, I did a lot of crazy things when I was drinking. I did a lot of things that normal people would not do. I woke up with a lot of people that normal people would not wake up with. And I'm sure they looked at me and thought the same thing. But none of that was insanity. I don't think any of that was insanity. I think every action I took was necessary to get my next drink. To me, the insanity that the second step talks about is the insane stuff that I think of stone cold sober. I recently had neck surgery and was prescribed pain relievers and muscle relaxers. And yes, I kept in constant contact with both my higher power and my current sponsor. I told him what I was prescribed, what I was doing. I didn't leave anything to chance. But the insanity told me, you know what? This is prescribed. It says right here, take as ordered. And as long as you take it as ordered, you'll be fine. That, to me, that's the insanity of this disease, telling me that I need more of these pills. I started cutting them in half. I didn't like the way they were making me feel, and I certainly didn't like the way they were making me think. And I've done other insane things like get married and sobriety. I've done crazier things. And so to me, the second step is about the insanity of sobriety and learning to trust in a power greater than myself. The third step, my ex-wife and I used to have a Yorkshire terrorist. I don't know if any of you know what a Yorkie is, but it's basically a dust mop without the stick. And we would take our Yorkie down to the groomers, and we would turn the Yorkie over to the care of the groomer, because the groomer knows what it's doing. See, my idea of grooming a Yorkie is you spray it with Nair. Okay, that's my thinking. The groomer knows what they're doing. And in the third step, I turn my will and my life over to the care of God, because he knows what he's doing. My sponsor had me reading in the big book every morning, the third step, and at night reading in the 12 and 12, the third step. And if I missed today, I had to go back. And I've already told you, I do the barest minimum possible to get by. So I made sure I didn't miss a day. But it was on day 16, on the top of page 62, when I read, Driven by 100 Forms of Fear. And it was literally like the doors of AA swung wide open. because I know what it feels like to be driven by 100 forms of fear, and I know enough about the history of our big book to know that it was written by the first 100 men and women who sat around the table saying, you know what, we need to put this into this book. You know what else we need to put? We need to put that we've been driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We need to put that in the book. We need to put this in. But when I read, driven by 100 forms of fear, I ran in it to show it to my sponsor, like he's never seen it before, you know? Look! I belong. And he and I got down on our knees and we did that third step prayer. And he said to me, now you need to follow this up with action. You need to do a fourth step. At that halfway house that I was in, they had me do a fourth step. I didn't understand what a fourth step was, and I told them, I don't know what a fourth step is, so they gave me this checklist. Okay, check here if you feel this, check here if you feel... Okay, that's wonderful. I still don't know what a fourth step is. But they gave me this fill-in-the-blank one, and then that did seem pretty appropriate since I felt blank most of the time. But then they gave me a woman's guide to an easier, softer fourth step, so now I'm in touch with the feminine side of me, and I want to decorate everything corduroy, which is my favorite color. But I still don't know what a fourth step is. And they told me to quit dragging my feet and do a fifth step. Well, not knowing what a fourth step is, I did not do a very good fifth step. In fact, I felt suicidal after it. So here's my sponsor saying, you need to do a fourth step. And that didn't sound like a good idea to me. And I said, oh, okay, I'll do it. And he said, I explained to him about the experience at the halfway house. And he said, no, we're going to do it out of the big book. Well, I didn't know it was in the big book. Why didn't anybody tell me that? I'm sure at some of the meetings I'd gone to, some of you people did talk about it being in the big book. But since I was sure I wasn't going to stay sober, I didn't listen when y'all were sharing. So I remember my first AA meeting. Somebody read how it works, and he said, rarely have we seen a person fail. And I said, well, I'll give you a rare opportunity then. So I didn't listen at meetings very well, and so I didn't know it was in the big book. And I thought, oh, okay, we'll do it out of the big book. That sounds great. And every meeting he would see me at, how are you coming on your fourth? Oh, I'm doing good. And he cornered me, and he said, okay, what page is it on? You know, that's a trick question. It's not on a page. It's on more than one page. But what it did was it made me quit dragging my feet and get to it. And I looked at the four column, and I realized I've been doing inventories all of my life. Who I've got the red ass with, why I've got the red ass at them, and what I'm going to do if I ever find them. Oh, wait, that's not it. No, in fact, it talks about who I'm resentful at, what action, what it affects, and then the fourth column, what's my part in it? At some point, I got the party started. For example, my older brother, I had a resentment against him dating back to my birth, but my older brother is not the sharpest knife in the drawer, and I knew that. And I would look up big words in the dictionary and use them in front of him and our friend to make him look stupid. And then he'd punch me and I would look stupid laying on the ground. Well, what's my part in it? Well, dishonest and self-centered and looking at my part in it. I carried a resentment against my ex-wife for several years for getting herself pregnant. And it was not until I looked at it in black and white, put it down and looked at that I realized, you know what? We were both in the same room when it happened. And she did not trip me, unzip my pants, and throw herself underneath me. I was a willing participant in that action. And it was actually very freeing to finally be rid of that resentment against her for becoming with child. I played an active part in that. And in the fifth step, admitting to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, I sat down across from him and I shared my fourth step. And I got another resentment while doing that. I got a resentment that he never looked at me and said, "Wow, you did that?" He was not impressed that a blind man could do all of these things. So I got another, but anyway. At that time, his lease on his condominium had run out, and I was renting a one-room apartment. The one-room apartment was so small that when you wanted to close the door of the bathroom, you actually had to step into the tub to shut the door. I didn't have a stove. I had a hot plate. There was no refrigerator. So it was a small one-room apartment. And after he kept asking me, "Is there anything else?" And I finally said, "No, that's all I've got written down." And he left. And I turned to the five or six women that were living with me and said, "Oh, I think that went pretty well. What do you think?" Okay. There was no one else there. The very next night, I was moving into my house. I had bought a house in sobriety, and my dad drove down to help me move into the house. And at 7:30, it was ingrained in me. At 7:30, you put your stuff away and you go to a meeting. And I said, "Dad, I'd like for you to come with me to a meeting. I'd like for you to meet my friend." I wanted my dad to meet y'all. And we walked in, and a buddy of mine was chairing the meeting. It was a podium meeting where you would walk up to the podium, you would share your experience, strength, and hope, and then you would sit down, and the next person would come up. And anyway, David greeted me and said, "Hey, what step are you on?" And I said, "Well, I just finished my fifth step." He said, "Okay, so the topic's going to be the sixth step." And I said, "Wonderful." And David immediately called me up first, and I walked up to the podium, and I realized I hadn't finished my fifth step. And so, in front of all of my friends, I finished my fifth step. I told them about the imaginary friend that I had living with me in this apartment, that I was so damned lonely that I'd created this false universe that I was living in. And I can sit here and argue, "Oh, that has nothing to do with drink." It has everything to do with drinking. It has everything to do with living, accepting responsibility. It has everything to do with it. Anyway, after the meeting, a bunch of us said, "Let's go to Mel's and get a burger." And my dad said, "Yeah, that sounds great." We got into his van. And he said, "Gar, does everybody do that?" I said, "Do what?" Does everybody spill their guts like that? And I really wanted to say something smart or flip and say, "Oh, yeah, next week it's Bob's turn." But instead, I did the adult thing and said, first honest thing I'd said to my dad in a long time, and I said, "Only if they want to stay sober." And I want to stay sober. My sponsor explained the sixth and seventh step to me, that the sixth step is when I think it, and the seventh step is when I do it. My shortcomings are when I'm sitting around thinking of wonderful things to do, and the seventh step is when I take action on it. For example, there was this pawn shop down the street that had a $1,700 Les Paul guitar. And I know if I buy that guitar, I'm going to sound like Jimmy Page. Even though I don't sound like Jimmy Page on any of the other guitars I own. And I have a credit card. I could go do it. but I don't need it. In the A, B, and C of how it works, when it talks about that probably no human power could have relieved alcoholism, that, to me, that's what that's talking about. Deciding to go buy a guitar so that I can change how I feel rather than just own up to how I feel and do an inventory on why do I feel like I need this. But a shortcoming is thinking about it, and that our defect of character is taking action on it. A couple of years, about 2 years back, I was at a memorial service for a friend, Horace, who had passed away. And this young 19-year-old girl was sitting next to me, and she was talking with me and talking with me. And I made sure she could see the wedding ring. I'm making sure she can see the wedding ring, and I'm talking about how wonderful my wife is and showing her the wedding ring. And I was telling one of my sponsees about it, and he said, "What, do you really think she had grandfather issues?" But my shortcoming told me that she was throwing herself at me rather than just feeling sorry for the old guy. The eighth step, I'm grateful for sponsorship because I needed my sponsor's help to go through the eighth step. And he pointed out to me that some of these people were active participants in the insanity as well. So some of them I do owe them in, some of them I don't. The ninth step, my sponsor said, "Hey, I'm going down to New Orleans. Would you like to go visit your son?" I said, "That's a great idea." He said, "Call your ex-wife, make sure that it's okay." And so I did, and she said, "That would be great." And we got on to I-10 in Lafayette, and he hit the door locks and said, "Now, let's talk about the ninth step." Like I was going to jump out of the car at 60 miles an hour anyway, but he was a smart man. He knew to lock the doors. Anyway, he said, "So, you're going to go make amends to your ex-wife?" I said, "I didn't sign up for that." He said, "You're going to go make amends to your ex-wife. Let's go over what you're going to say to her." And I said, "Okay, fine. I'm going to say I really wasn't a good husband," because I wasn't. I was a drunk, and I'm sorry I wasn't a very good husband, but I'd have been a better husband if you hadn't been. And he said, "Stop right there." "Stop right there. This is not about her side of the street. This is about yours. Do you care if she drinks again?" I said, "No." He said, "Do you care if you drink again?" I said, "Yes." "Yeah." He said, "Okay, so you're going to clean up your side of the street, and what you're going to say is, I was not a very good husband. How can I set this right?" I said, "Suppose she wants me to marry her again." He said, "I heard your first step. She's not going to want you to marry her again." And she didn't. What she asked me to do was to be a good father to my son. And that amend went so well that I went to my parents' house and I called an ex-girlfriend to make amends to her. And my hope was that she would say, "Oh, well, you didn't hurt me that bad. In fact, why don't you come on over and hurt me some more?" And I called her up and I said, "Hey, this is Garland, and I'm sober, and I need to make amends to you. I wasn't a very good boyfriend, and I'd like to set that right." And she said, "You really want to set that right?" I said, "Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Daddy's ready. How can I set this right?" She said, "Kill yourself." And I learned a very valuable lesson. Number one, my motives have to be right. And number two, it's not up to me to determine how much I've hurt someone else. I'm not the one to measure that. They are. And after that experience, I put off doing my ninth step for a little while. Until one day, my son and I went into a Blockbuster Video, and I was just overwhelmed with fear, and I said, "Grab something, let's go, let's go, let's go, let's go." And I wound up having to watch a Pauly Shore movie with him. To a 9-year-old, a Pauly Shore movie, this is Oscar-worthy stuff. to me, this was the most mind-numbing pablum I've ever seen. I cannot believe he got paid to do this. And I said, okay, if I'd never want to go through this again, so I better finish up this ninth step. There was one amend that I had to make. It was driving at me, and I could not get rid of, and I had to make the amends. And I called her parents' house, and her mom said, "Haven't you heard her enough?" and hung up on me. I said, "Yeah, and I'm talking to the dial tone. Yes, I know I've heard her. That's why I'm calling." So I sat down and I wrote it out in a letter. And the statute of limitations had not run out yet. I mean, she could have gone to the DA and said, "Look, I've got a signed confession from him. Arrest him." And yeah, they do put blind people in prison. But I, you know what, prison would have been okay. Dragging that around, that shame of what I had done to this poor girl, I couldn't do it. So I sat down and I wrote it out. And about 2 weeks later, this envelope comes in, and it's from her address, and it's in that real girly handwriting. And I called up my sponsor at his work, and I said, I need you to come here, please. And he came, and we opened the letter up. And in the letter, she said, I'm glad you're getting the help you need. She forgave me. Two years later, I still have a hard time forgiving me. But she forgave me. The tenth step is doing an inventory of my day. And I don't know about anyone else, I can only speak for me, but I have a tendency to look at the negative. At the bad stuff that I've done all day long. I was such a jerk. And so what I do when I'm on my knees is I think of 10 things that I am grateful for during the day. And what it does is it forces me to look at my day. And I thank God for those 10 things that I'm grateful for today. If it's possible to have a favorite step, the 11th step is my favorite because I get to continue to develop my relationship with God. And again, I can only speak for me, but God speaks to me. And God reaches out and touches me. I mean, y'all were all witness to it earlier when God reached out and rubbed my head at the beginning of this meeting. Because I can't think of anything that I could have ever done to have a young lady trust me enough to rub my head. And when my wife hugs me and tells me she loves me, I can't think of anything I've ever done that would deserve that. And I don't like cat. I think the Chinese have the right idea. They taste like chicken. And about 12 years ago, my wife and I were working in the yard, and she said, "Well, aren't you a pretty little thing?" And I said, "Thank you." She said, "Not you, this cat." And I said, "Okay, listen, I don't like cats, and I don't want that thing in the house, and I don't want you feeding that thing." And we compromised, and it's in the house, and she feeds it. And that cat sleeps on me. And whatever she has to get to, I'm in the way, so she walks across me. And when she does that to me, it is the hand of God touching me and letting me know that He is thinking of me. And the 12th step, I honestly thought I was doing something wrong because I just did not feel that conscious contact with God. I did not feel that I'd had my spiritual awakening. I didn't feel I was going to meetings and there were some people there that didn't even need furniture because they just levitated. They were so spiritual and I just wasn't there. What am I doing wrong? And I remember I was attending college at the time and I was sitting outside of Burke Hall smoking a cigarette and it was time to register for my next semester and I said, okay, God, what classes should I take? And it really hit me like a thunderbolt. I have a relationship with God. In fact, I talk with God and I trust God. I had done something drinking and sober that I hoped and prayed God was looking the other way when I did it. I was so ashamed of some of these things. And I went from being ashamed to having a friendship, a relationship with God. When I asked my wife to marry me, on my knees in front of her, I made her a promise that I was going to be the best husband she's ever had. I've got two ex-wives and a bunch of ex-girlfriends that can tell you that I have no right to make that kind of a promise. But that's why I do things like this. That's why I tell my story when I'm asked. And I'd like to thank Tim for asking me, and I'd like to thank the Blue Chip Group for having me here tonight. And I sponsor people, and I go to meeting, and I work the 12 steps. Because I want to keep that promise to my wife. I want to be the best husband she's ever had. Now, I didn't ask any of you if you believe in God. But do you believe that I believe in God?
Thank you for that, Garland. Very powerful story. I've heard it before, but I got to hear it in person, which makes me very happy. Thank you for that. I forgot to. Mark, will you give out the chips for me, please? Way back there, Mark, please. Let's check. Hey, they're up here.
My name is Mark, and I'm an alcoholic. We're at the Blue Chip
Monday night speaking meeting. We have a chip system which represents the left of sobriety. I have first chip I'd like to offer is the white chip. Does anyone want to try a way of living just for today? Okay. We have a silver chip for 30 days. We have a gold chip for 6 days, 2 months. We have a red chip for 3 months.
All right.
We have a yellow chip for 6 months. We have a green chip for 9 months. A blue chip for a year, multiples thereof.
All right. All right. My name's Clay, and I'm an alcoholic. My 11th birthday was actually yesterday. I came to the old timers meeting here, and they did not hand out chips. So I had to come back and get one. I was forced into these rooms with a nudge from the judge, like a lot of us, but it stuck. I got in here and listened to the similarities instead of the differences. I floated through for a while, wasn't working the steps, didn't do the steps, but I was getting it. I didn't want to drink anymore. I was tired of the trouble that I was in, all the consequences. So I was faking it until I made it. And long story short, it wasn't until about a year and a half ago I found a 7 o'clock in the morning meeting up there near where I live in Beaufort and started getting it and started working the steps and started calling my sponsor regularly instead of once a month. Like I said, this is 11 years. It's been this year. It was the first time somebody asked me to be a sponsor. I'm now I've now got two sponsees. This program does work. Stick around. It took me a long time to finally get it, but I've got it, and it's amazing. So thanks, y'all.
Does anyone else have a birthday anniversary? Does anyone want to reconsider on the white chip? Give yourself a hand for the chip you hold.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, one and all, for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Son, I never see.